how did you, how do you think he would get a sense of this milieu? What tipped you off early on that, that he was the right
guy? He gave an interview, I thought he said just the right thing. He said, this is a character-driven movie. And that was spot on what I hoped he would say, or something like it. And characters are the individuals and also the city. And I think he keyed onto that immediately.
What was the first thing about the city that struck you as odd as you walked into?
The physical beauty hits you right in the face. You've been there, you know what I'm talking about. And you can see it in the movie. The physical beauty also is isolated on the Georgia coast. There's no urban sprawl. There's that beautiful downtown and then marshes and the ocean and piney woods. So it is like a little hidden, you know, community, and it's a remnant, surviving remnant of the old town. Very strange to come upon a place like this. The pace is slower. I happened to go, the first time I went was in the spring when there were always flowers in bloom of some sort, but in the spring it's unbelievable, you know, in North Carolina. You get it about 2 weeks later. Mm-hmm. But it's the azaleas and the wisteria and the I went there in the middle of all of that, in March of 82. And the physical beauty, and there's an invisible kind of quality too, the atmosphere, the taste, the warm light, soft light.
At what point did you have the germ of the type of book that you saw on the side?
I already knew about the shooting. The liberty I took was to put it in the middle of the story, but I knew I had that to work with as a story. But it was the city I just described that first struck me. And then I met people like Joe Odom, and Jim Williams, and various other people. One of them, I thought, they're all acting out their works of art, which are their lives. And lives are a work of art in the South. People dote on other people's lives. As they don't up here. I mean, it's a very different kind of thing. They really watch each other as an unfolding drama. I mean, they love strange behavior because it makes gossip all much better.
So how did you feel about the way Mr. Hancock brought in the John Cusack character to kind of link everything together for the movie?
I think you have to do that. By the way, Cusack is wonderful. Yeah. I mean, he's bright and attractive, but witty and hip and all the things you have to be to play him. and John Hancock had a very, very tough job, one that I was too chicken to do myself. It almost an impossible job. There are over 100 characters. These stories are loosely linked in the book, and he took on a really difficult task. I knew that you couldn't do a carbon copy of this book in movie form, and he's got a lot of guts to do something like that. Because unlike some movies like Forrest Gump, people didn't know the book that well when the movie came out. They didn't have to hold it up to the book. With this, the book is very well known. And it took a lot of nerve to take on projects like this. And as I said, I didn't have the balls to do it.
You talk about the book being well known, which is kind of an understatement. It's been on the bestseller list for 3 years now. I know it's a tough question for you to answer, but why do you think it has that popularity and people go back to your book so often?
You know, that's a question I've been asked a lot. And it's funny thing, I've done various answers that I've been given, various elements. It's word of mouth, basically, although I have not been shy on the publicity trail either. But somebody sent me a tape cassette. I got it yesterday. This was a reading group from South Carolina. They're both monthly answers. They said, we read your book, and we had a discussion, and here's the tape of our discussion. And I could see, they came in, it was in somebody's house, and there's all sorts of ambient noises going on. They loved the experience of reading the book. They were laughing about the characters, the love should be, and Joe Uggerman, and they were just giggling and laughing, and I can see what drives the word of mouth. I mean, it's the first time I've been present without their knowing it, so they're listening to this tape. So I've heard people who didn't know me and you know, who didn't know I was listening, talking about the book for the first time. And I can see now because they truly enjoyed the experience.
Just to clarify, what took you to Savannah initially? The idea
exactly what I said in the book, which was that airfares was so low that it made sense to hop on a plane instead of spending money up here on nouvelle cuisine.
And
so
we were going to write.
I wasn't writing. No, I went to Savannah in '82, and I just couldn't believe my eyes. No, I didn't. That was '82. Came back, and I just kept thinking about Savannah. Everybody goes done. And it wasn't until 3 years later, actually. Okay, 3 years later, I decided I was time to write a book. I've been a magazine person until then. And so a friend of mine said, I'm thinking of various things to write about. And the friend said, you love Savannah, why don't you do that? I said, why not? So by that time, Jim Williams was in jail, having been convicted a second time. And I called him in jail. And he agreed to talk to me, so I went to see him in jail. And then I decided in 1985 to move down there and write a book. I knew that his story would be in it, and I knew immediately that it should branch out and take in all the characters, and I should weave them into a story.
Like in Cold Blood, this trendy nonfiction novel. Is this a nonfiction novel?
Yes, but I didn't have the arrogance to call it that. What it is, you see, Random House looks at it, so there's a real challenge here, and that is that it's nonfiction, but it reads like a novel. It's not any one genre, and that was a real problem for some publishers, although all the publishers you saw have been on it. But with fiction, all you have to have is a last name to put on the shelf under your last name. With nonfiction, it's either got to be history, biography, true crime, or various specific genres. This is neither. This is like a novel, but it's not. It's like a biography, but it's not. It's true crime, but it isn't. Travel, but it's not. Whatever. So there was a marketing problem for Random House. But and they said this is a nonfiction novel. The reason I didn't call it nonfiction novel was that there are only two writers who had done that before: Truman Capote with In Cold Blood and Norman Mailer with Executioner's Song. I thought, who am I to say that I've written a third? You know, here I am, John Dan. So I didn't call it that, but Edmund White, on the back of the book in his blurb, called it a nonfiction novel, so I felt that he did. But indeed, it is a nonfiction novel.
Mr. Hancock, aside from creating the character of Mr. Bear, essentially wandering through the city and conducting the trials, what were the big nuts to crack in transferring of a novel, a love novel,
mm-hmm.
to this?
I think there were many, and I think probably the biggest obstacle is the fact that I have, that I love the book so much and I have so much respect for John as a writer and as a friend, because I've gotten to know him. And that hangs as a specter over your work. Obviously, there are lots of different characters that may or may not know one another, that may or may not be involved in some way with the murder trial. And so you have to include them in the story in a way that seems fitting and seems to have some of the same drive, because the film is obviously a very different medium. It has different requirements. I think it would have been very easy to make something of the book that would have been very A, B, C, D, right down the line, here it is, you know, tough, firm spine to the narrative. Didn't want to do that. One, because I'm not crazy about those kinds of movies, and two, because that wouldn't be embracing the heart of the book. So what we tried to do was to have a narrative, but to be a little more flexible with the spine, to be able to take the time to chase rabbits, if you will, and to enjoy some of Savannah and the colorful characters. And then if we can somehow wind our way back to the spine every so often, then to do that.
I'm sorry, Jamie. How on the script page do you convey a sense of the city? I mean, is it all Clint's doing when he gets on the involved location, or is it something that you can write?
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm the writer, so I'm going to say it's there, of course. But I've been to the place with Clint, so I would say half of it is just, it's probably most of it actually is the director saying things he likes and drawing from the book and from the script and saying, this is described thusly, and I think this is probably the best way to shoot this. You put things down. I mean, I borrowed freely from John's description. I mean, you read the script, I think you probably noticed that. Not only, as much dialogue as I could possibly fit, all the best dialogue in the movie is John's, and trying to cut that back was tough, but a lot of his description as well.
Mr. Barron, I said it's character-driven, but there's something of a text in it that I almost call it a tone poem. A certain musicality to it, and it takes these unexpected events and so on. Were you conscious of that in the fashion industry? It's not like the perfect world, is it?
No, it's not. And when I was first offered the book, it came. It already been set at Warner Brothers when the book first came along. It was offered to me to read and then to come in and talk about. And I was busy working on something else, and it sat on the desk for a few days. And I'd been meaning to read the book because I'd heard such wonderful things and read the great reviews. And so eventually, I got to the book and read it and just adored it. And thought about it and came in and called Warner Brothers and said, I pass. Thank you very much for giving me the book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's on my shelf now, and I'll recommend it to everyone. But I pass. I think this is really, really, really a difficult adaptation. I can't imagine taking a more difficult one. And I thought about it and thought about it. And they said, well gee, that's too bad. It's wonderful. Yes, it is wonderful. I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And finally, one night in bed, my wife said, you're still thinking about the damn midnight, aren't you? And I said, yeah, there's got to be, you know, and I just, basically, she said, you should put yourself back in the arena, the arena, the possibility of writing it still exists. You should do that. And so I kept thinking and kind of came up with a take, so to speak, and called him and said, look, if you haven't given a gig away, can I come in and beg for it? And thankfully, they hadn't, and I did, and I got the job.
This is for both of you. How much of Kelso do you see in yourself, and how much of Barrett is Kelso? I mean, are you really as journalistically, ethically slippery as this guy is?
No, I'm not slippery. Be more specific, and I'll answer your question.
How much?
He didn't give me a painting. If that's what you want to know. No. And that's the point that I said you should not accept the painting. And he did, but that's not a bad problem.
But Kelso's a man who crosses certain ethical lines in terms of his relationship to the subject of the
Tell me, be specific, because then I'm going to try to answer.
Oh, well, he's helping this guy.
when I was told that the narrator had to be more of a character, I said one of the directions you could go is strategizing. Don't forget, I only came along after two trials had been done. So there was a third and a fourth. I was fascinated by the case, and I did, on occasion, suggest to Jim things that his lawyer should put emphasis on. But I mean, there's no way structuring the case, because I was busybody and interested in it. And one of the things I suggested turned out to be a disaster. I said, you ought to have Danny Hansford's girlfriend come on and talk about how violent he was. And he got her on the stand in the last trial, and she showed up in a cocktail dress. Not know how to handle it. And they never did ask. I guess Sonny decided he couldn't ask about the virus because it was not, he would not have been allowed in. So she made something of a rule of stuff. And it was not a fight. So that was my one conclusion that was definitely. But I did sort of say a little tiny thing I was thinking, you know, Spencer Lawton, who was thinly larger than the deal in the movie, had a blackboard and picked off the 9 points of evidence. And Sonny gave a brilliant close in the third trial, but he didn't have a board. And I said, in the last trial, he should have. He should say, okay, the DA is going to show you all the bits of evidence. Why don't you have your board up there? Do it first, so to help them in the deliberation. And he did that. But by then, by the closing arguments, Sonny had won that last trial anyway. He won Augusta. So I really did not cross the line. I don't know.
How much of Mr. Barrington?
John did a wonderful thing in the book. I mean, it's basically, with the exception, I think, of a couple of chapters, kind of first person Italian, and yet you never feel as though he's the guy that the focus is on. He is there, and I think that's part of the appeal of the book, which is John, he's our eyes and ears. And that's why we feel like we've experienced this when we hear him talk about the characters in Savannah. Obviously, that's kind of a very much a last man notion from a cinematic standpoint, and you have to have. I always felt like, because there were different suggestions that different people had of ways to crack the book, and it seemed like they would pick one character from a Savannian from the book and decide that that person should be then the protagonist of the movie. And I always felt that it had to be an outsider, because the thing is a Savannian, they would look around. I mean, The fact is, Savanning would have never written this book. they would look around and say, what's so unusual about this? That's just Luger. He's not that dangerous or anything. They would never write the book. And because of that, you need to have somebody who can, and John Hughes, that's a perfect fit. His jaw can drop along with ours. And we need that. And in making a protagonist more active, and somebody who's, an out-of-towner from New York, a writer, these are traits that obviously we share with John, and John was very helpful to John, to me, John. Was very helpful, I think, in helping him to understand what he saw first, how he felt about Savannah when it came, and also to give him some insight from the world of from the magazine world and things like this. And it came down to some of the silly things or simple things like what backpack he would carry, which kind of recorder, how you these kinds of things that just add to the reality of it. And I think so. Those traits he obviously shared. With John. I know that when I had to then think about making him more active, I drew from things that John, like John just told you guys. Also that Sonny had said to me, Sonny had told me that because Jim and John had, had good conversations, and Jim had a certain understanding of what was going on, the book was going on, and he was writing and things like that, and Jim obviously enjoyed John's company, and they had great conversations when Jim was in and out of jail. And Sonny said, "Well, hell, Jim won't talk to me, but he'll talk to John." So it's hardly that John was doing Sonny's bidding at the same time. I'm sure that Sonny would have liked it to have been stuff.
Well, Jim resented spending any money with the lawyer. Constantly referred to the money, and I wasn't charging him. So he was more relaxed.
But I bring up Thomas Hardy. Thomas Hardy once said that the environment changed character. So Savannah, a testament to that.
Savannah nurtures what you saw in the book, the characters. Character, I would say, the South episode, backbone. Typically South. And I think, to some extent, I think what you say is true, that he gives a gray area.
The sensibility of Savannah is quite different from Charleston.
Yes, very different. And in fact, a lot of people in Savannah have never been to Charleston in so many hours to begin to play their car. It's amazing how cloistered they are.
But it's a different sort of town because...
Totally different.
Because it's a much more party town, for instance. It's well known for its inviting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in many ways, Charleston is a very different.
How did Savannah change you?
Well, I was very New York centric before then. I thought you really had to be here to live properly. You weren't a fully formed human being, and you haven't been to New York. I discovered when I lived in Savannah for 5 years, people who had never been to New York and no intention of going to New York, but leading fulfilled lives and elsewhere. So it did open my eyes a bit, and I'm a less of a regionalist than I was, and I've always loved that.
Did you start treating your life as a work of art?
No. I'm an observer.
You are something of a character.
Only that's happened despite, but I'm an observer. I look around and take things in and use what I see. My life is less interesting to me than lives I see.
Did you feel part of that community, or did you always feel like an outsider community?
I began to feel part of that.
You did.
It's a dangerous thing, because it is an outsider. They began to think I was. You see, after I was there for about 4 or 5 years, and there was no book, they just didn't think I was writing one. The rumor goes, oh, he's not writing a book. We see his column in Esquire, but he's not writing a book. He's just one of our many eccentrics. His quirk is that he's supposedly writing a book. They didn't think there was one after all.
What is the gossip about you now?
That I wrote about. They like it. I mean, 99% of people like it. When I go there, I feel like a superstar. So it's a good thing I don't live there.
How did you feel about the John Cusack's character in the screenplay?
Well, I knew he would have to be more of a character than I was. I was a shadowy presence in the book. So I was prepared for that. I don't think differently at all. I mean, the romantic thing, it didn't happen, but... That is in no way intrusive. It doesn't interfere with telling the story. And I think it's very nice to see it. Very light.
Did any of the characters that from the book came out Yeah. I'm thinking in particular of what's his name?
Lee Adler?
Yeah.
But interesting things have happened with Lee Adler. He hated the book first. And I saw him a few weeks later. I was in Savannah. I went to a restaurant in the West End of the bar. And I walked up to him and I said, "Hi, Lee." And I put my hand out. He said, "Don't touch me. Don't talk." And so I walked away. 9 months later, he came up to me in another restaurant, shook my hand, and said, "Got to hand it to you. It's a great book. Done a wonderful Savannah. And I'm famous." And he's learned to live with and love the book, I think. I shouldn't speak for him. I might get in trouble doing that. But I saw him, I was in Savannah about a month ago and posing for yet another photographer. And he came into Monterey Square, he waved and called out, "Hi, Adele." So he's okay with it. His wife hates the book. She said that I, and he, this is a good line that Lee came up to me. He said, "You know, Emma," "thinks you pulled off the literary equivalent of a drive-by shooting against her." Well, she's the only one in Savannah who wouldn't talk to me. So, I had to use her words for the newspaper. I had to take her quoted words and the piece she'd written for the newspaper. And it didn't show her the best advantage, but that's her problem. So, she probably doesn't like it. Now, she's spoken to me too since then. It was nice. But Lee come around to enjoying it.
He was very helpful with the when we shot in Mercer House. He's obviously still next door.
Mercer used his house. Yeah.
He was wonderful.
You couldn't see this in the movie, but when they were shooting the film in Mercer House, and I was only there for a few days, there were lights that would splash all over Lee's house to provide depth if you saw out the window of Mercer House during that scene. So he cooperated.
How about Dorothy Kimmerer?
How about
Dorothy Kimmerer? Is she? Where does that?
She's hardly in the books. She's just on the receiving line.
On the receiving line.
In the receiving line. In the party thing. Oh, yes, and she's there once after the third trial.
So she's still trying to.
She's trademarked the thought of Mercer House and demanded that every artist who draws a picture of it give a chance to sell, if she lets them do it. Mm-hmm. She's not too popular.
How did you like, sort of, what did you think of the choice of John Mercer's
music as the bass? The only thing they could have played off of immediately telling them he was John Mercer's music, I think, great. It starts with Katie Lang acapella singing, Skylock. Ends with it, too. And then she gets, suddenly some orchestration by the way, that's more credible.
You're known in publishing for having been protective of this book. It hasn't come out in paperback yet. And, you know, it's said at least it's because you said you didn't want it to come out in paperback yet. How did you feel about this whole process of giving up control of this, your first book? It was a breakthrough for you. It changed your life. And it was probably in many ways really dear to you. And, I mean, it's now become something beyond you, and it can never, you can never now own it completely again.
I can't. The book. You see, the book is always going to be the book. And what changes there are in the movie, I was prepared for it. Mm-hmm.
I have it in paperback.
You can give an English version.
Well, I got it in England in September. Mm-hmm. Is there a paperback release planned yet?
Yes. Yeah. We sold the rights. It was supposed to come out in January of 95, over 2.5 years ago. And fortunately, the paperback house that bought it is vintage. It's a trade paperback. It's owned by Random House. It's the hardcover. So when it came time, they were all set to go into paperback. I said, "No." And I'd have to sell 4 paperbacks and they could have made one hardcover. So I said, "No." And they said, "You know, he's right. That is 2.5 years ago plus. And a million and a half hardcovers so far."
Is there a paperback edition coming out in connection with
that? No, it's a hardcover.
Still hardcover.
Clint liked the cover of the book image so much.
Yeah, he uses it
in the And I said to Random House, "Guess what? You don't have to change the cover." So they did a little banner. Mm-hmm.
This is my British paperback. It's a nice quality paperback.
Well, I can write. No.
How closely did you two communicate and cooperate on?
I think either one of us could answer that.
John I met John in for the first time in Savannah. He introduced me around, and he was really, really helpful to me in several ways. First and foremost, in an understanding that I would have to meet the people, spend time with the people on my own. Certainly he didn't have the time to do it either, but that I would have to find Savannah for myself and to understand through the book and through the people there what it was all about. And then at some point re-engage with John over a script, and that time came once Clint was involved, and Clint and I had worked on the script some additionally, and then sent it to John because I felt at that point then he could really, really be quite helpful. Also, then I'm saying he was very kind to kind of stay away and let me do that, because it had been rather daunting with him kind of looking over my shoulder. I needed to get a first draft with all its mistakes and wrong turns and things, and so that he could look at it. And I have to say, he was quite gracious when he called, because there's always an expectation when you send a first draft. And he's like, this isn't a completed one, but read this. He pointed out very specifically, what he thought worked, what he thought didn't work, and he was very helpful.
This is for both of you. We're talking to Jack Thompson and what made him write for Sonny? Sonny's somebody we have to instantly underestimate and then surprise us during the course of the film.
He was cast by Phyllis Huffman, who saw him in a film where he played Sonny. He's Australian.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's wonderful. He's just like Sonny. Really, he captured the fire, the spirit of Sonny Tyler. Sonny's the judge in the movie, you know. You ask him, I think he's very good. Plus, Sonny was born and all that.
They're going to use Nick Nolte.
Yeah. You see, I let me just say that when I sold the rights, John sold the rights, right? He thinks that the to keep it all from me as a writer. In Hollywood, a writer who sells the rights to his book and then hopes to have some input in the movie, like a whore who hangs around expecting to serve breakfast. But I understood that before John told me that, because he was saying in terms of the screenwriter.
The screenwriter on the set usually is
someone like me. Too. I decided when it was going to be made into a movie, this was going to be a version of the book I would have no control over, even if I'd written the script. My best lines would have been taken out of the edit. So I decided to stay at it. Because it would be a terribly frustrating experience. Writing the book, I was in charge of every single word. This would not have happened with a movie. So I decided, don't get into the whole thing where I'm involved to the point where I'm furious and I can't sleep. So I said, let them do it. So John sent me the script, I gave him my impressions of various things and we discussed them. And in no way was I in charge of it. I mean, I could say, this thing I think doesn't work, whatever, and that would be up to John to decide whether to change it or not. So, and I understood that. So what I did get involved to the degree that I reacted to his script and made some suggestions. But beyond that, I did not go to the filming of the movie except the first few days, and then I poked my nose out. I did not ask to see the dailies, which I could have done, because I understood that by asking Clint to see the first draft, and then no one asked for my first draft. So I really did stay away from it. Not just the writing of the script, but the filming of the movie and everything until now. I saw for the first time last night with you.
Did you have any doubts that Shabu could turn in that kind of performance?
I know Shabu well enough to know she could be just
But there's going to be a big difference between that character.
No, Clint handled the joke right. I said to Clint, but I said to Shabu, after the book came out, I said, all you've got to do is be Shabu yourself. You've got a really deep job. And I said to I told him to just be herself. He said, that's what I'm trying to do. And I just let them get a rapport going. And he worked it right. He got the essential. She comes across as she is.
How has the success of this book changed your stature in your life? And how do you follow up a book that's this big?
Well, some people say, how can you top this? And I don't think I have to.
Mm-hmm.
I say to them, you do it first. somebody's saying, I didn't see you do it. Do it again. So all I have to do is something that's worthy of my ability.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to try to tell it. This kind of thing hasn't happened before, and it's unlikely that I can make it happen again. Mm-hmm. But when I write another book, it'll be, I hope, as good a book or well written.
You
may not have the time of a
book. Are you working on anything right now?
Yes, a story that's set in Venice, but I don't think it's a book one. It's a good story. It's a non-fiction story.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.